Ovechkin storming in. Alexander Ovechkin curl and drag to the backhand. He scores! Simply sensational!
Inside Lacrosse Podcast here. I am Matt Kinnear with a very, very special guest, someone I am extremely excited to talk to, Joe Benedetti, who is calling Major League Lacrosse games this week and has been the longtime voice of the Washington Capitals on the broadcast. Joe, this is really, really exciting for me. How are you doing today?
Matt, my pleasure. Good to hear your voice. Great to talk with you, and it's even better that we're doing so in a week where we're involved with live sports. It's a rush for me to be in the booth. I love being there with Quint and with Booker and Don Zimmerman and our TV crew. So to be back in the act is wonderful, and I look forward to reminiscing with you now over the next few minutes.
This is certainly fun. It was great to hear your voice last night. I know you're probably a little sleepy. You were in a rain-delayed game that went a little late, but we won't hold that against you. Just, you know, you mentioned live sports, the rush you get. Can you just kind of explain further, what's it like to be back, and what are some of the challenges of, you know, having a little bit of time off, maybe some rust, and then just the unique aspects of this tournament, calling a game during a pandemic, and some of the safety issues that go around with that? How has this been for you?
Man, there's a lot of unpacking to do right there with that question, so let's try to pick it out piecemeal. First of all, I mean, I've been lucky to do, in my lifetime as a sports announcer, 8 different sports. But when the pandemic put a pause onto NHL play, I think it was the second week in March, right? Right around March 9, 10, I think, was the last time we had worked on a Capitals side. I cannot recall in my professional life going more than 4-plus months without calling a live sporting event, whether it be from football to hockey, from hockey to lacrosse, and year-round in my schedule. I don't ever remember a 4-month period where I didn't go to work, per se. So that, in its own right, was a little bit stunning or off-putting to me. But the thing that I was happiest about when I did my first live game with Coach Zimmerman at Navy Marine Corps Memorial Stadium to start the return to play for Major League Lacrosse, I was happy from a rep standpoint. I had 0 reps in 4 months, but it fell right back into cadence, right back into rhythm. I didn't feel, what's that expression that boxers use? I didn't feel a lot of ring rust. So I was happy about that, and that's obviously part and parcel to doing what I've done for, you know, almost 30 years now professionally, better than 30 years now professionally. I didn't expect to have a lot of ring rust, but I was pleased that it didn't show. There are lots of challenges to doing this, whether it be Major League Lacrosse, whether it be the NHL return to play and future Stanley Cup playoffs. With no fans in the stands, Matt, a lot of the times, I think announcers would certainly tell you, we draw from the spectators. A lot of fire, a lot of energy, a lot of our enthusiasm comes from fan reaction in the venue. This is different. There's nobody in the seats. And with respect to hockey, upon return to play, there's going to be nobody in the seats, and you're not going to be there as a professional announcer calling the game. You're not 6 stories above Capital One Arena. You're going to be calling the game from a TV monitor while it's being played in Toronto or while it's being played in Edmonton. So, yeah, there are challenges there, and we can get into specifics from a play-by-play announcer's role as to what makes that difficult or what changes things. But I'm grateful that Sandy Brown, Major League Lacrosse Commissioner, gave me a buzz about a month ago and said, you know what, we think we're going to make this fly. And, you know, good on the commissioner, good on the league owners, great on the players and the players' council for getting together and making this all come together as well as they have. And knock on wood, we're halfway through it. Things have gone very well. I'm amazed at the way the players and coaches have performed in that heat over the first 4 days. Just proof positive that they're remarkable athletes. But for me, as an announcer, I can't tell you how happy I am to be back. It was way too much time. You know, we always say, boy, I wish I had some time to enjoy my home and be around the house. Well, the last 4 months, way too much of that. It's been good to make that drive every day to Annapolis. It's been great to get in the booth and strap on a microphone.
You know, I think most people know you best for your hockey work. But like you said, you're a very diverse broadcaster. You've done a number of sports, particularly a lot of lacrosse. What is your background in the sport, and how did you get involved in broadcasting lacrosse games?
No, that's fun for me to think back on this because my late father was a really good baseball player. I mean really good. Like, in his late teens, early 20s, invited to spring training by the original Senators, the Washington Senators. And the dum-dum hurt himself. He was a sprinter on the track team, too, really fast, great middle infielder. Hurt himself before he was supposed to go down the same season he was supposed to try out and arrive at spring training. So the Senators said, nah, we don't need you without your arm. But my dad was a great ball player. Long-winded way of me saying that, sure, when I was younger, all I wanted to be was a hockey goalie, and my dad and mom put me into youth hockey, and I grew up in that scenario. But I was a baseball player up until my freshman year in high school. And I was going to make the baseball team, and I was going to be the starting shortstop. I just knew it. And I went out for tryouts in high school baseball, and wouldn't you know it, the darn coach cuts me. And I'm like, damn. And I'm walking off, and I'm a freshman at the time, and I'm walking off the field, and I'm heading back towards our, you know, whatever our gym or our field house complex was back then, and the lacrosse coach sees me walking. He goes, hey, aren't you that little freshman hockey goalie? I said, yes, I am. And he goes, have you ever played lacrosse? I said, no, not at all. And he hands me this butterfly net, and I take the stick, and I stand in a hockey goalie stance with it. And he goes, no. In lacrosse, we stand up, and the goals are bigger. He goes, do me a favor. Please come out to practice tomorrow. And, Matt, I swear, I did, and I fell in love with the sport. I really did. I did not play youth lacrosse. I did not start till I was a freshman in high school. But I picked it up quickly, and it became so much fun for me to go from winter hockey goalie to spring lacrosse goalie. And there were some changes and obviously a lot of modifications in the way you play one position compared to the other, but I genuinely fell in love with lacrosse. I played more lacrosse in college than I did hockey. And it was another scenario where my freshman year in college, I hurt myself right before captain's practice of hockey, couldn't play. Buddies of mine were campus radio station disc jockeys. Hey, we describe these games on the air. Do you want to do play-by-play for us? And I'm like, really? And that's where I got involved in the broadcasting part of it. But I played as a varsity lacrosse goalie all 4 years in college. My senior year was one where I finally earned the starting job and had a pretty good season and set a record for single-season saves, which was a blast. And I loved the game. And the first chance that I had, Matt, to broadcast it, I want to say it was 1999. I think it was 1999. There was a made-for-TV event. It was set in Princeton. I remember it was either Princeton and maybe there was a game as well in Villanova. Then in 2000, Jake Steinfeld approached me about possibly getting involved with Major League Lacrosse in the showcase. Quint and I had done games now for about a year together. And all of a sudden, there you were. You know, add lacrosse to your resume of sports broadcasting, and I loved the sport. I love the way it moves. I think the cadence of it, the rhythm of it from a broadcast standpoint is similar to hockey. I think because it's a larger stadium field size, it probably lends itself to a little bit more shutting up. You lay out a little bit more in lacrosse than you do in hockey as a play-by-play announcer, but it's genuinely been a love of mine for the last 20 years to call the sport, and I relish every chance I do get to be in the booth with it.
That's fantastic. Your story is similar to my story with lacrosse. I was a hockey player. My hockey coach also coached lacrosse. So one day my sophomore year, he said, when hockey season's done, grab a stick, you're going to play on my team. So that's how I got in. How many people get exposed to the sport is probably through another sport. Joe, you've been doing this for 20 years with Major League Lacrosse. Not only do you get to see these tremendous athletes, but you've been able to see a lot of growth in the sport and a lot of changes in the sport. Can you walk me through some of the things that you've seen over 20 years in terms of the bigger picture for the sport of lacrosse?
Positionally, tactically on the field, the change that I always look for, and I'm obviously fond of goalkeeping, I'm amazed at how professional, just first of all, how good they are. I mean, I'd like to think that I played lacrosse well in college, and then you step out and you watch Major League Lacrosse level players, or today's, I'm sorry, even Division III, Division II, high-ranking D1 college players. They're phenomenally good. The skills of these young men and women are incredible. I mean, off the charts, incredible. The athleticism, I think it was there. I know it was there when Major League Lacrosse first began, but it's cool for me to watch how positionally goalies have changed the way they play. And it's from a stance and from an arc standpoint, a depth in the crease that when I was playing, I never involved the use of it. And today, lacrosse goalies fill the net up somehow by playing as deep as they do, and they're able to wait longer to react on shots. They're able to better react laterally on as the ball is moving across the crease. So just positionally over the last 20 years, the way the goalie position has changed, not only in lacrosse, we're speaking about lacrosse, but especially so in something like hockey, where nowadays Braden Holtby doesn't look like anything that Ole Kolzig was in 1998. The position changes, and it modifies, and you get better. And we've seen that, I think, in lacrosse, especially in the goal, and especially with the focus upon face-off work, these specialists who are so incredibly well-trained and well-schooled at what they do, and then they put it into effect on the field. I mean, that's not to say that today's face-off guys are better than Paul Cantabene. I'm not saying that, but I would imagine that the effort involved, the tactics involved to winning a draw are probably different now and trained and schooled and counseled differently than when Paul and his ilk were learning their craft and becoming the best of the best at what they did. That, to me, just tactically, the way coaches approach the game. You know, we can argue about, is it overcoached? I'm sure we can have that discussion, but just the amount of time and effort that's put in the film room, all of a sudden, you know, lacrosse has become very much similar to the way football puts an emphasis on film. Everybody is pre-scouting. Everybody is devising plans to be their best and put their players in a position to succeed. Well, that's just a matter of lacrosse keeping up with the Joneses and all these other sports. And it, with the advancement of technology and video and all the computer interaction, I think it's amazing. If you want to be great at something, you really can. If you have that that God-given natural ability that some of these players, most of these professional players have, you can work, you can study, you can train yourself into being an outstanding player. And the more I've seen it grow at the pro level, it's been so much fun to see the grassroots grow up, to see more young boys and girls playing the sport. And not just in the hotbeds, not just in Maryland, not just in New York, on Long Island or Baltimore or upstate. You're seeing more and more players arrive on the scene, whether it be in major college or pro ranks, from really unusual places. I would never have associated Utah with lacrosse, and all of a sudden I'm seeing so many birthplaces attached to Utah or the western part of the United States. Denver, all of a sudden Texas, and you know how many quality athletes are raised in the state of Texas to eventually be football. We all know about the Friday Night Lights scenarios in Texas, but more and more now, the great young athletes in that state are finding that they can fall in love with lacrosse. And I'm sure that has happened with the advancement of the D1 programs, with the advancement of now, two professional leagues. Young boys and girls are watching more lacrosse. They're seeing it more. They're getting more acclimated to it, and they gravitate towards it. They embrace it. And I think that's only, obviously, only a good thing for it as we move forward.
Last night on the broadcast, you guys were taking a little trip down memory lane and talking about the Pals and the Gates and some of those early days of Major League Lacrosse. In your time calling MLL games, is there a player who maybe rises above the rest in terms of how fun they are to call?
John Grant Jr. John Grant Jr., who I believe I said was gimping around the field last night. I feel for John Grant Jr. at age 45, trying to get your muscles to work the way they did when they were 25. I'm fortunate to have seen John Grant Jr. Burst onto the scene, and I will never, ever forget his collegiate work. I'll never forget him working internationally for Team Canada. I'll never forget what I have seen on a pro lacrosse field. Otherworldly skills, amazing mind for the game, and obviously that's, you know, what's going to lend itself very well to him being an offensive coordinator, whether he's doing so for the Outlaws or he's doing so for the Johns Hopkins Blue Jays. This is a wonderful lacrosse mind and incredibly gifted. When you think about his creativity, what he can do with the lacrosse ball, it's stunning. And I do remember his first couple of years in the league. I want to say he had 40 or more goals. I think it was 3 years of the first five in Major League Lacrosse, of his first five. I know he took a few seasons off there early on, but my God, just talented. And that was the great thing. Whenever I get together with Quint, I know how much Quint loves the sport, and it only inspires me when we get together, when we're on the air together. It's a passion for Q. And it's one of the loves of his life. You can tell. And great recognizes great. Quint was a spectacular goalie in his day, and me as some wannabe D3 goalie can only dream of being as half as good as Quint. I mean, one quarter as good as Quint. But when I see him react to pro players the way he does, and it's genuine, you're like, whoa. You really are seeing and commentating on something special. And any of those names, you just look at an all-time list of Major League Lacrosse's all-time leaders, and you wind up just going, your jaw drops. The first time I was involved, Matt, with Major League Lacrosse, and I had the chance to put my flip card, my game board together, I could not believe every single guy that I was putting on my list. Three-time All-American, Player of the Year, Attackman of the Year, Goalie of the Year. The pedigree, the amount of awards and accolades that these guys had accrued over their time in college was stunning. You were truly seeing the best of the best. That's why it drove me nuts that I didn't understand. I still to this day don't understand why the sport isn't more popular than it is on the air, because we do like to see best of the best. And especially in the early days of Major League Lacrosse, you could just point a finger at any player on a roster and go, wow, amazingly highly decorated, incredible player. And then you had the best of the best. You were talking about the Powell family. You were talking about the Gates. And all of a sudden, in a whole field full of high-performance cars, yeah, oh boy, there's the Ferrari. Every one of those cars on the track is incredible, but oh, there's the Ferrari, and you could start to spot greatness. I mentioned just one name in John Grant Jr., but I couldn't believe how well Jesse Hubbard could shoot the ball. Couldn't believe it. And I asked Quint. I didn't realize that Quint had faced Jesse in. I think he mentioned to me maybe in a club scenario. And I'm like, what was that like? And to hear Quint describe that shot, you know, those sorts of things, those are the stories around the campfire that you just love hearing about. But the amount of players who took your breath away then and still do now, I don't know. How do you create Lyle Thompson's gifts? How do you recreate that? I mean, you don't. He is sublime. Watching him every time I get the chance to call a Chesapeake game now, my powers of description, very similar to what I would say about Alex Ovechkin, this guy challenges your powers of description every night. You are likely to see something that you've never seen before. I don't know where he comes up with it, but he does it so fluidly, so smoothly. Not only does he make defenders look silly, but he challenges you to describe it. Okay, put your words to that. Sometimes it's best to just shut up and admire. He's incredible. And there have been countless numbers of those guys that I've been lucky enough to call in lacrosse since the year 99 when I started in it, 2000 with the showcase, and 2001 on with MLL.
I'd say you were the John Grant Jr. of broadcasting, given your attention to detail and preparation. You know, anyone I've ever spoken to about you, you know, whether it's Mark Dixon with the Big Ten Network, whether it's Quint with ESPN, always commends that you come into every game extremely prepared and ready to go. Can you walk me through a little bit of the preparation it takes to call a lacrosse game?
Sure. And Matt, the only way you can really do that is be surrounded by people who are incredibly cooperative. And the one thing I do notice, and I'm not saying that professional athletes and coaches are not cooperative, because I do work in the pro sports ranks quite often. They are. But I find more so in amateur sports and collegiate sports and in sports leagues such as Major League Lacrosse, that there's a level of cooperation from the coaches and from the players that only helps me with my prep. And I'm not saying the pro sports can be a roadblock to it. No, that's not what I'm saying. I'm just saying that the others that I mentioned, and especially the amateur ranks, they bend over backwards to help you. Oh, can I give you 5 more minutes of my time to describe how we're planning to clear tonight? You know, something like that, that I can spend with a coach if I'm on a call with Quint, with the rest of our TV crew, if I'm on just a text chain individually with a coach. These coaches and players are so giving of their time. They want to help you describe their favorite sport to the fan. And you, as an announcer, you're a conduit between the players and the viewers or the listeners, if we're talking about radio. So I want to be able to bring as much knowledge from the players and coaches angle to any broadcast that I can. Not overdo it, but I do want to have a roster, a list of items that we discussed leading up to this particular game, where all of a sudden maybe I can clue in a viewer to something that he or she might not have had any access to. And that's what we're all involved with respect to media. But when you're talking about a game broadcast, I want to have background on Matt Kinnear. I at every game that I go into, want to have at least 5 to 10 things about Matt. That could be sport-related, specific to his goal-scoring totals or his save percentage, but it's also another 5 things about what he likes to do when he's off of the field, what he studied in college, what he's doing now, aside from his athletic endeavors, where is he working? Is there a connection between Matt playing in the year 2020 to somebody who might have been working in the league in 2005? So we have this list. I prepare a flip card that I refer to that's on an 11x17 sheet. And it has every player who's going to be on the field that night, on one side for the Cannons, on the other side for the Outlaws. And I spent a lot of time culling information and putting it on that sheet. That's my own homework in advance of a game. So today we're talking, for me, on an off day between a Major League Lacrosse doubleheader Tuesday and a doubleheader for me on Thursday. I've already started working on the Thursday games, but today is when I really put my emphasis on making that flip card sing. It's for 4 teams, and usually you're only doing a single game for 2. But so I'm preparing background, I'm looking at rosters, I'm making sure I'm reading through past press clippings or media guides, and then what becomes super important is a phone call to a coach, a text with a coach. We had last week a 2-hour-long conference call with all 6 coaches, conversations with the MLL commissioner, conversations with the players. We had 2 days of training camp at Navy Marine Corps Memorial. We were on the field. We were talking to players. We're just kibitzing around. There are some things that are off the record, Matt. There are some things, though, that I might get from John Grant Jr. while watching a Denver Outlaws practice. All of a sudden, I'll find out. I'll learn some things that I will jot down and use maybe on the first day of the Major League Lacrosse season. Maybe I'll wait until Championship Sunday to use it, but you're trying to gain as many information and as many bullet points as possible. The day before, the night before of a game, I'm writing some potential, what I would call scene set teases for the games. The producers are really kind. They allow me to put my own spin on those. Those are the little 20 to 30 second video clips that people see that start the telecast. I write those, so that I'll be spending a good portion of time doing that today. The amount of time that I will spend memorizing names and numbers, for the most part, the hay's in the barn there. I've done that before the actual tournament or before the actual regular season this week unfolds. Now it's a matter of rewatching some games. We'll be at day six tomorrow. So I want to remember something that Quint mentioned about Denver's clearing game, and I'll go and find it on a videotape, and I'll see it, because I want to have a list of things that I want to speak about with the analyst. So not only am I preparing for two teams, but I'm preparing for the telecast. And the telecast is produced and directed by two different people. The producer is the one who puts and itemizes the bullet points together. Hey, we want to focus on the Gates and the Powells. Hey, we have the Outlaws and the Lizards. Let's reflect back on their past championships. You know, we have the Barrage coming back. Remember when they were a dynasty. So the producer, he or she, puts that list together. We study all those possible elements so that we're ready on game day. We have this massive amount of information. I think you can understand by what I've been saying. We have an incredible amount of information at our fingertips, but we never know which percentage of it we're going to use. That's dependent upon the game. It's dependent upon which player has a great day. It's dependent upon which coach makes a call that maybe Quint or maybe Coach Zim says, you know, I might have done it differently. So you prepare as heavily as possible. You may only get 20 to 30% of your preparation in on any given day, but you never know which 20 or 30% it's going to be. So you need to be very well prepared for the examination, for the test that's in front of you, not only for the four teams that you're calling tomorrow, but for the entire league. And when you're doing a national broadcast, as we are on ESPN this week, you're not just the Bayhawks announcer. You're not just the Hammerheads announcer. You're the announcer 50-50 down the middle. You don't have a rooting interest one way or another. All you root for is great games and great telecasts, but you do need to know the whole league. And there's it is a huge amount of prep work. And by the time we get to 7 o'clock or 4 o'clock, that to me is the fun part. All the traveling around the world, all these endless hours of homework and film study and phone calls. Yeah, they're I enjoy it. Don't get me wrong, I do. But it is homework. It is work. To me, the game feels like, all right, here's my chance and our chance as a TV team to shine. And I look at it, I approach it that way, and I think we have, in very many regards, it's similar to the way coaches and players approach their performance. We do on the TV side. We do on the radio side. You want to do the best possible job you can. If you're going to do that, you better prepare for it. I learned that a long, long time ago, and I don't think that'll ever change.
You know, you put a lot into it, and we talked a little bit beforehand about how these moments, how your voice means so much to people, you know, people who have such strong memories, such ties to the Capitol, so many, you know, heartbreaks and joys and successes that they've lived through hearing your voice. What are some of those, with the Capitals in particular? I have to go down memory lane a little here. What are some of your favorite calls and moments as the Capitals broadcaster?
Far too many to mention, but I'll try and think through a couple for you, Matt. So I've been blessed to be in the D.C. area since 1994. I worked one, two, three, four, I think it was five seasons in the American Hockey League in Portland, Maine, and in Providence, Rhode Island. And I came to the NHL. I got my NHL big break in 1994, right in the middle of a work stoppage, in the middle of a labor dispute. Congratulations! You're on your way to the NHL. There is no NHL. I should have known right then and there that I was destined for greatness. But we didn't play that first year till January. I remember a lot from that first year. All of a sudden, things are starting to blend together now, 26 years of NHL broadcasting. But you're asking me for moments in particular that stand out. Peter Bondra breaking Gartner's goal-scoring record. Peter is as genuine as they come. He is, you know, in my business, we're not supposed to play favorites, Matt, but thinking back on more than a quarter century of work with the Capitals and at the athletes that I've encountered and had the chance to describe, Peter is one of my favorites. There's no doubt about it, and I'll never forget the night that he set the goal-scoring record, eventually to be broken by the Great Eight. Thrilled for Peter, and I hope someday he's welcomed into the Hall of Fame, a 500-goal scorer. I think he deserves to be there. That's just a personal opinion, and I hope he's nominated soon and will eventually someday get there. There's the time in 1998 when the Caps burst through all of their playoff troubles, heartbreaks in the past, failures in the past, pushing all the way through to a Stanley Cup final, and never forget the way the building reacted to the playoff run. The amazing amount of overtime wins in that season for the Caps, when normally in the playoffs overtime spelled their doom, for whatever reason, against Boston and Ottawa and Buffalo, they had success in overtime. They pushed to a Stanley Cup final thanks to an overtime game winner by Joe Junot. I wasn't on the call of that particular game. By the third round at that time, the local rights holders, whether it be known as HTS or Comcast Sportsnet or now NBC Sports Washington, local rights holders could do, at that time in 98, you could do two rounds. So Craig Lachlan and I had the pleasure of calling the games against Boston and against Ottawa in those first two rounds. I'll never forget how good Ole Kolzig was, especially in the second round series against Ottawa. Godzilla was at his flame-breathing best in that series. He was so good again and out-dueling Dominic Hasek in round three. And then the Caps ran into that buzzsaw named the Detroit Red Wings in 98. But still, to be in a Stanley Cup final, to feel the electricity throughout the city of Washington, D.C., was amazing, even though they didn't get a win on the board. It was something that I will never, ever forget. There are, you know, the day of the Jaromir Jagr trade, a lot of people will say Jaromir Jagr with a forked tongue if they're a Caps fan, not only for how he hurt them as a Penguin, but even during his time here in D.C., where many people feel like he didn't achieve or reach the level. Oh, he didn't. We know that. He went on to even bigger and better numbers once he left, but I remember the day of the trade and the excitement that you were bringing one of the game's greatest and gloried names to town. That one stands out. Like I said, Matt, there's so many, but for me, I'll never forget meeting Alex Ovechkin and him being a teenager at the time. He was not able to, well, his first, he was drafted in 04. There was no 04-05 season, but I think he was still contracted to play back home in Russia. He would not have been a rookie in 04-05 had there been a season. That was the lockout canceled year. But I'll never forget him coming to the building after the draft parties and all. He came to the rink. The rink had no ice at the time. The subfloor was down, like you'd see before a basketball event. But Alex could see the boards. Alex could see what the shape of the rink was. And I'm standing next to him, his heart basically beating out of his chest. Can I go skate? Can I go skate? I had to say, Alex, there's no rink there. There's no ice down. He thought maybe the ice was under the subfloor, but it wasn't. And he couldn't. But the genuine excitement of this man-child wanting to go out and play the game that he loves. I just, at the time that I met him, he was so passionate, and it's never, ever waned, Matt. It's never, I've never seen it shrink in terms of his love of the game, his enthusiasm for the game, the thrill he has when he scores, the joy he shows when a teammate scores. It's fabulous, and it's never, ever changed, and I don't think it ever will. In 2006, I did the Olympics in Torino, Italy, and Alex Ovechkin was part of the Russian team. I think he and Evgeny Malkin would have been the youngest players on that roster. I'm not positive, but I think they were. And I was lucky enough to be calling that for Westwood One. I did the national radio broadcast for that tournament. And I'll never forget, I'm standing in an empty arena, basically, or maybe 20 other media members, but an otherwise empty rink in Italy, and Team Russia starts walking out, one superstar after another, just, you know, watching the team step out for practice. There's no way you would think that that team could ever lose because of their individual skill set. And there's Alex, and he recognizes me in the stands of the empty arena and lets out this blood-curdling scream of hello, and he attached an expletive to it, and I will never forget how embarrassed I was that he called me that name, and that he did so during an Olympic Games where we're like, everything's all buttoned up and security's there, and he's laughing, howling on the ice, and I'm like, I don't know you, you freak. And ever since, it's been a pleasure to refer to him as Freak Show. He and I share that common nickname. He gives that to me. I gave that to him. We don't use it on the air. We do it in conversation. Since he arrived, I mean, the amount of great events are through the roof, just through the roof. But they're not all about Alex. It's not. Game 7 against Boston, when the Bruins were the defending champs, the Caps beat them on a Joel Ward overtime goal. I had the good pleasure of calling that. Phenomenal. Never forget it. Jason Chimera, double overtime playoff goal. Long overtimes are usually the Caps' death knell, but Jason Chimera, crazy-looking goal against Lundqvist in Madison Square Garden. Double overtime game. One of the best games I think we've ever called on NBC Sports Washington or Comcast Sportsnet, whatever it was at the time. Too many, Matt. Like, we could spend 3 hours on this. Too many great ones, but I've been blessed by those guys on the ice. They've treated me very well.
You're giving me flashbacks to Joey Juneau and Issa Tikkanen right now.
With this conversation. How did he miss that open net? How did he miss that open net? Ugh.
It'll haunt me forever.
They weren't gonna beat Detroit. Nobody was gonna beat Detroit. But in either of those years, remember, they were champs in 97 and 98. And the 98 team just was one Hall of Famer after another. And sure, if Teague scores in that game, perhaps they win one. But they weren't going to beat Detroit. Nobody was.
And I was in the stands in that game 4 to see Detroit hoist the cup, which in itself was a cool experience as a youngster, seeing the Stanley Cup for the first time. Joe,
Vladdy Konstantinov in a wheelchair.
Yeah, it was a special moment.
Yeah, oh yeah.
Joe, I know you got to get preparing for the rest of this week of MLL, so I'm going to leave you with one question.
Sure, bud.
You talked a lot about Alex Ovechkin. He certainly the most special athlete I've had the privilege to cheer for in my lifetime. If you gave him a lacrosse stick, what could he do on a lacrosse field?
Ooh, great question. I have seen Alex on a soccer pitch. I have seen Alex shoot left-handed threes on a basketball court. His mom was a phenomenal basketball player. I want to say captain of a Russian Olympic basketball team. His dad was a minor league pro soccer player. So there's that interest in his blood. And Alex is legitimately, Matt, 6'3", I would say, and a thick 235 pounds. He plays at that size. When I met him, I think he was 220. I think he was 218. He's probably in the 230 to 235 range now. He has thickened over time, although his physical fitness level, as I see him getting back to the return to play next week, his physical fitness level is really good right now, which is getting me excited about seeing what he's got in store for us. But I'm just thinking of a big bear of a crease attackman. From a hand standpoint, he would be, I mean, from just from a physical size standpoint, he would be the kind of guy who could bulldodge down and just keep backing you in where you'd have a difficult time defending him. He runs well. I don't know. He doesn't run like Jacob Vrana. Jacob Vrana is probably the Caps' best in a 40-yard dash. Much lighter, Jacob Vrana. Jacob Vrana is probably 205, maybe. Probably less than that. Runs really quick. Explosive legs. Alex is a truck. Alex is a big bear of a guy who's going to take you behind the goal. If he's playing midfield, he's going to invert, and he's going to lean on you. I wonder, I don't know if he's ever even picked up a lacrosse stick. I've seen him shoot threes. I've seen him run around on a soccer pitch. He's an incredible athlete. I guess he'd get the hang of it pretty fast. The only thing he's horrible at, he's a horrible golfer. Don't let him fool you. He didn't get any friggin' hole-in-one. He took 80 swings, and the ball went in on that hole. Okay, is that a hole-in-one? I don't think so. It's not a hole-in-one. You can't stand on a golf tee on a par 3 and swing 80 times and have one go in and call it a hole-in-one. But he did, son of a gun. Some guys are just lucky like that.
This has been fantastic. Joe, I appreciate the time. MLL fans, you can hear and watch Joe in the semifinals and the championship game Saturday and Sunday from Navy Marine Corps Stadium. Joe, thank you so much for the time.
Matt, this was great. It was great talking with you. I appreciate it.